Mahaprabhu attempts to go to Vrindavan, but he failed. He reached all the way up to near to Navadvip, or even around Navadvip. And what happened was, he was coming from Jagannath Puri, and for years he had sought permission from the devotees to go to Vrindavan, from the senior devotees there, take their permission and go to Vrindavan. But year by year they postponed the Lord's departure for Vrindavan, because that would take the better part of a half a year, and they had already waited out the separation when Mahaprabhu was in South India for nearly 2 years. So they weren't anxious for Mahaprabhu to go away from Jagannath Puri. But eventually they ran out of excuses. During the rainy season, they would say, it is better if you wait until Kartik. That is a very nice time. When Kartik would arrive, they would say, it's really too cold to travel now. And by the time the winter was over, they would say, soon it will be time for Rath Yatra. Why don't you wait until then? So after a while, they ran out of excuses. And then Mahaprabhu set off for Vrindavan via the route of the Ganges. Means he went up through Orissa to Bengal, and then to and then he would connect to the Ganges and go towards the north. But what happened is, by the time he reached Bengal, there was a crowd of about 10,000 or plus people following him. And in fact, in one house that he stayed in, so many people tried to enter the house that it broke the walls of the house. The house fell over. So it was a small, humble dwelling, a dignified mud hut type of dwelling, thatched roof, as people used to live in India in those days. But so many people stuffed inside, it pushed the walls out of the house and it fell over. So this became a problem. He met Rupan Sanatan, a place that was called Ramkeli. Sanatan Goswami said, after some time, he said, my Lord, it doesn't look good to go to Vrindavan with so many people. That won't be good. So there was some dialogue about that. Then Mahaprabhu considered that advice, instruction, and he decided to return to Jagannath Puri. So this is where this begins. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu arrived in Jagannath Puri, he visited the temple of the Lord. News then spread all over the city that he had returned. All the devotees then came and met the Lord with great happiness. The Lord also embraced each of them in great ecstatic love. Kashi Mishra, Ramananda Rai, Pradyumna, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Vaninath Rai, Sikhi Mahiti, and all the other devotees met Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Gadadhar Pandit also came and met the Lord. Then, before all the devotees, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu began to speak as follows. It was my decision to go to Vrindavan through Bengal in order to see my mother and the river Ganges. Thus I went to Bengal, but thousands of devotees began to follow me. Many hundreds and thousands of people came to see me out of curiosity. And due to such a large crowd, I could not travel very freely on the road. Indeed, the crowd was so large that the house and the boundary walls of the house where I stayed were destroyed, and wherever I looked, I could see only large crowds. With great difficulty, I went to the town of Ramakeli, where I met two brothers named Rupa and Sanatana. These two brothers are great devotees and suitable recipients of Krishna's mercy, but in their ordinary dealings, they are government officials, ministers of the king. Sri Rupa and Sanatan are very experienced in education, devotional service, intelligence, and strength, yet they think themselves inferior to straw in the street. Indeed, the humility of these two brothers could even melt stone. Because I was very pleased with their behavior, I told them, Although you are both very exalted, you consider yourselves inferior, and because of this, Krishna will very soon deliver you.
Purport.
Such are the qualifications of a pure devotee of Krishna. Materially, one may be very opulent, experienced, influential, and educated. But if one still thinks himself lower than a straw in the street, one attracts the attention of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or Lord Krishna. Although Maharaj Pratapurudra was a king, he took up the broom to clean the road for Lord Jagannath's Rath Yatra. Because of this humble service, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very pleased with the king, and for that reason, the Lord embraced him. According to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instructions, a devotee should never be puffed up by material power. He should know that material power is the result of one's past good activities, karma, and is consequently temporary or transient. At any moment, all one's material opulence can be finished. Therefore, a devotee is never proud of such opulence. He is always humble and meek, considering himself lower than a piece of straw. Because of this, the devotees are eligible to return home back to Godhead. Hmm. Foremost qualification of a devotee is humility. Hmm. If a devotee has real humility, this will attract Krishna. This will attract the mercy of Krishna. Hmm. So if there is something which is the best, then the opposite of that is usually the worst. Hmm? You follow? Hmm? So, if you want to attract Krishna, you have to develop humility. You may be learned, you may be unlearned. You may be a good cook, maybe a bad cook. Not even a cook at all. Of course, you have to be something. You have to learn some devotional activities. But none of those guarantee that you will attract Krishna. What is your cooking compared to Mother Yasoda's cooking? How tasty the dishes can you make compared to the tasty dishes that she can make out of substances which are eternal? Mm-hmm. She starts with ananda. Satchit ananda is a substance of the material world. So she's making things which are themselves eternally blissful. Mm-hmm. Making things to offer to Krishna which start off on that level. We are starting off with things which are just totally mundane and tend to spoil, putrefy, and rot the things of this world. They are only usable at a certain moment. But things in the material world do not undergo those, in the spiritual world, do not undergo those types of transformations. And then on top of that, the level of her devotion and stuff. So what is our cooking in comparison? So we may be a very good cook, but simply cooking is not enough to attract Krishna. We may be very intelligent, a very good manager. We may be an excellent speaker. Or we may be a dumb fool by the Vedic standards. Actually, if you don't know Sanskrit, you're called uneducated in Vedic standards. It doesn't matter what else you know. If you don't know Sanskrit, you're uneducated. It'd be like in this country, if you knew so many things but you didn't know how to write your name, or you didn't know English and you couldn't read, that would be uneducated, wouldn't it? Regardless of how good of a computer software programmer you were, you would still be considered illiterate because you couldn't read, uneducated. So on the Vedic standard, which is a spiritual standard of society, because it is the Vedas that contain the spiritual wealth of that society, and Sanskrit is the language that is written in, if we don't know Sanskrit, we would be considered uneducated. That's from one point of view. However, within those spiritual textbooks, it is said in many places, one who devotes himself to the holy name of the Supreme Lord is considered the most wise amongst wise men. So, if you devote yourself to the holy name of Krishna, you may not even know how to read or write the language you speak. Nonetheless, you will be honored as a very wise and educated person even in the assembly of demigods like Brahma, Shiva, and others. The quality of humility, however, is the single most adorable quality of the Vaishnavas. It is, Kaviraj Goswami calls it the crest jewel in the crown of Vaishnava qualities. It is the foremost. So the opposite is the most undesirable quality that we could possibly have. And we would certainly not want to cultivate the opposite of humility, which is what? Pride. We say puffed up. There used to be a saying, the only thing that's allowed to be puffed up in the temple are the puris. Everything else should be subdued, humble, and particularly the devotees. So this humility attracts Krishna very much. In all the qualities of devotion, he finds it the sweetest. So it is said that one should take the position of a straw in the street. One should be more humble than a straw in the street. So from one point of view, the straw in the street, this is the most negligible thing. It's not even feedable to cows, actually. Once a straw has reached the street, we don't gather that straw anymore, even to feed the cows. It's not even sufficient as cow fodder. You see, it's lost any usefulness. Why? Because the street has so many dirty things in the street. So, having come to that level, so we should consider ourselves more insignificant than the straw in the street. Well, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur once wrote that our position is even worse than the straw in the street. Because at least the straw in the street doesn't offer any resistance. The straw in the street is just the straw in the street. If you broom it to the left, it goes to the left. If you broom it to the right, it goes to the right. But we condition souls. Krishna wants to broom us to the right. We go, hey, you know, what about my life? You know, I got. What about my independence? What about my freedom? We have so many whatabouts. You see, Krishna wants to move us to the left. We have some complaint. He says our condition is worse than a straw in the street because we offer resistance. We practically don't even believe that there is a God. We practically don't even believe it. And when we come in contact with so much personal information, we accept it, but then do we really believe it? Do we really believe that the Supreme Personality of Godhead came to this earth many, many thousands of times to deliver the fallen souls? Do we really believe that God is a person in the eternal childhood born, playing in the groves of Vrindavan with his eternal associates? Do we really believe that the spiritual world is existing? Every moment there is eternity. Do we really believe this place is a place of suffering? Well, in the stage of Madhyamadhikari, which is our stage, we go back and forth with this for a long, long time, you see. Back and forth. When we come to the stage of Uttamadhikari, that's the highest class of devotee, then it can be said we really believe it, because at that point we have no other even flickering attachment for anything less than Krishna, for anything what this world has to offer. But if you are truthful with yourself, you have so many attachments and attractions in this material world. Madhyamadhikari is still dealing with that plane of final determination, final surrender. Uttamadhikaris. Madhyamadhikaris are not ultimately, finally, fully surrendered souls. They're on the path. Lower than them are the, what is it, the Kanishadhikaris. That path is supposed to be very short in this life. That path was long in previous lives. So many people have some faith in God, some belief in God. In different religions all over the world. They're like a type of Kanishadhis. Very little faith, very, very little interest, very little piety, very little activity, spiritual activity. Then in this life, we live some time, we come in connection with the devotees of the Supreme Lord. We come in connection with Guru. We come in connection with the holy books, with the Mahamantra, with the deities. We should only remain Kanishka after that a few days. possibly a few days, maybe 1 week, we'll give it a month after that. Kanishtha should be finished. Mm-hmm. So if you want, you can read all the details of the Kanishtha Adhikari. And these things, when you read them, well, this is a Kanishtha Adhikari. For example, he does not see the value of devotees. He or she only wants to worship the deity. This is one symbol of a Kanishtha. He thinks that God is only in the church or the temple or only in one particular place. He thinks that his organization is the only organization for God consciousness in the whole universe. He thinks that his guru or her guru is the only guru. There is no other. These are all symptoms of a Kanishtha Adhikari. So when you see these symptoms, every once in a while you'll see that, oh, this is ridiculous. Some particular idea that God exists only in your temple, nowhere else. Something like that. Then you'll see, oh, it's very easy. This should be left. This should be left behind. All these qualities should be left behind immediately, and then we embark on the path of a Madhyamadhikari. And many qualities, positive qualities of a Madhyamadhikari are given. And that is primarily the lifelong journey. That is a long journey. The Madhyamadhikari is a long journey. It is one of much discrimination. Do, don't do, good, bad, clean, unclean. Much discrimination. The land of discriminating. What is favorable, what is unfavorable, what is good, what is bad, what is useful, what is not useful, what is the right thing to do, what is the wrong thing to do, discrimination. This faculty of discrimination is one of the things that separates the human species of life from all the other little cute species of life roaming around the planet. They lack proper discrimination. Particularly, they can't discriminate between matter and spirit. Now, a cow, just by smelling, can ascertain whether a plant is edible or not. You see? Even good forest people have to get out their books and look at the thing. There are so many types of mushrooms that look alike and so many things. But the cows, they just go around in the fields where there's a lot of weeds and things like that, and they smell the good and the bad. And they just pick accordingly. You see? They have this facility to discriminate what to eat. They have a mating season. They have different things where they discriminate what to do. But to discriminate what is spiritual and what is material, thought never enters their mind, or to speak of an ability to discriminate. So this is where discrimination reaches its greatest utility. In the human being, he or she can discriminate what is material and what is spiritual. Knowledge doesn't mean how to make a rocket ship. According to the Vedic standard, Sankhya's definition of knowledge is the ability to understand what is material and what is spiritual. So who has this ability? Say Gaurakishore Das Babaji. Or I'll give you another example. You haven't heard of him very much, but his name was Bumsi Das Babaji. Well, Bumsi Das Babaji was a contemporary of Gaurakishore Bhaktivinoda Srila Bhaktisiddhanta at that time. And he was very much a figure in the life of the Gaudiya Mutt devotees of the time. Well, just prior to his being a devotee of the Supreme Lord, he was a river pirate on the Jalungi and the Ganga and other things. Those are the old days, more than a century and a half ago. He was a river pirate. And he was uneducated by the social standards. Similarly, Gaurakishore Das Babaji is said to have not been able to read. Couldn't read Sanskrit, said he couldn't even read Bengali. But he loved to hear. So devotees would read to him Bible Tama, read to him Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he had a tremendous Gaurakishore Das Babaji, also Bhansi Das Babaji, they had a tremendous facility, a faculty of discriminating what is material and what is spiritual. So much so that even they could distinguish when the scripture was being read spiritually and when it was being read materially. But some of them were saying, oh, but that's the Bhagavatam. Said, Bhagavatam, the Bhagavatam, that's just so many chopped down trees ground in the paper. And with ink smeared all over the pages. What makes the Bhagavatam is just not the book, or something is valued at that level. But the recitation of the Bhagavatam by the reciter is really what makes the Bhagavatam, the Srimad Bhagavatam, or the Bhagavad Gita, or not. And there was an incident where one Sahaji, a commentator on Srimad Bhagavatam, he had come to Gorkhasur Das Babaji, and he had invited him, "Oh, Baba, please come to my katha. I'll be speaking Bhagavatam. And I'm at such and such location. The tent is there, and please come and sit and hear the Bhagavatam." So, "Yes, thank you, sir." And that man went away, and Gorkhasur did not go there because he knew the man to be an unbona fide professional reciter. He had no interest in it. Maybe he'd heard about him, maybe he just perceived it on the spot or something like this. But he had no interest to hear that man, so he didn't go. So because Gorkhasur Das Babaji didn't go, so many class devotees, proper devotees, they also didn't go, you see. If Gurudev isn't interested, then, or the Acharya isn't interested, or the Paramahansas are not interested in something, then the intelligent devotees go, "What's the use of it?" And they didn't go. So then this frustrated that gentleman, so what he decided to do, and then, of course, seeing that many of the known devotees weren't going, just the regular people, they weren't going either. So his whole program was a flop. So what he did is he just moved his tents over from wherever they were and set up, like equivalent of across the street, but it wasn't a big street in those days. I mean, just across the driveway from the hut of Gorkhasur Das Babaji. And then, of course, the word was the pandal is set up at the location of Gorkhasur Das Babaji, and Bhagavatam was being read. So then, at least the ordinary people, they were duped into coming. And the man held his program there for 7 days. It's called Bhagavat Saptaha. Bhagavatam is read from cover to cover in 7 days. So when it was over, and the whole thing passed, and during that time, Gorkhasur just locked himself in his hut and didn't show his face. He just stayed inside his hut and shut the door. Didn't come out and show his face during that time for 7 days. When it was over, and the tents were packed up, and the man was gone, and Gorkhasur was left there in his place as he was before it all started, he requested a servant, "Please go there and sprinkle the place with cow dung and cow urine to purify that place." And his servant said, "But why does that place need to be purified? The Bhagavatam was spoken there. The Bhagavatam is the supreme pure literature. The Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of the Supreme Lord in this age. It is a literary incarnation. It is non-different than Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the Bhagavatam is read there. Why does it have to be purified?" And he said, "Bhagavatam? I didn't hear Bhagavatam. All I heard was rupee, rupee, rupee. Give me rupee, rupee, rupee." So even the words were being spoken from Bhagavatam. Gorkhasur, that isn't Bhagavatam. That is his pratishtha. He wants honor and he wants money. He's just using the Bhagavatam as a livelihood. So some people have such discrimination that they can understand when even that which is purely spiritual is no longer purely spiritual, contaminated by the presentation. Another example was in more current times. There was a devotee once, and all of a sudden he started to manifest extraordinary symptoms of ecstasy while chanting of the holy name of Krishna. He was a big acharya in England, and right around this time, Bhagavatam class, he would chant and chant, and this chanting would keep going, and sing Jai Radha Madhava, and it would go. Once it went up to 3 hours, almost 4 hours. Several times he rolled, fell off the Vyasasana onto the floor, and it was a high Vyasasana too. It's quite a drop in those days. So, so he'd had to be there to know the humor behind it. And Everyone thought, prema, bhava, at last, somebody broke through. Real unending ecstasy, not just, you know, jumping up and down in the kirtan so the girls will see you, but some real ecstatic kirtan, like playing the madanga so everybody will see you. No, some real ecstatic kirtan. They thought, this is finally, finally somebody. And the thing became a huge issue. And even that person was asked, you know, he was asked, what do you experience? And he was saying, I can't explain it. He says, Krishna's mercy, divine love. You know, I cannot be held to blame. Krishna's to show us all, he's showing me, making an example of me, and all these things were coming out. And it was a torn committee, you could say. And it was spread all over the world. And the recordings of it spread all over. Some people were, oh, God, what is this sound? And others were like, wow. And they could not decide, even at the highest level of the GBC, they could not come to a conclusion. What is this? So they decided to take that tape, there were many, take one of these tapes to Śrīla Śrīdhara Mahārāja and let him hear it. Because they knew that he had the capacity to distinguish mundane sound, even if it was the holy name that was being chanted, and spiritual sound, which is coming down from the eternal plane, which is eternally connected there. And you see, the real holy name of Krishna, in the beginning, you chant Hare Krishna, and in the end, Hare Krishna dances on your tongue. You are not even the chanter anymore. That is the real, when the real name of Krishna descends, he takes over completely. He orchestrates the kirtan. You don't. You're just, at that point, almost a bystander. Of course, you're chanting, but he is conducting that chanting. In the beginning, we move towards the holy name, and we are behind that chanting. But when the chanting is pure, the chanting itself takes over. It is another sound from the beginner's sound. It is not recognizable to any set of ears, that's for sure. In fact, sometimes those sweetest kirtans that come around on tapes and DVDs now and again, they're not spiritual at all. They're sung just for public glorification, attention, money. They are not sung from the heart of love and purity. So they decided, we'll let Śrīla Śrīdhara Mahārāja hear these tapes because he has such distinguishing capacity. So they didn't tell him anything about the controversy, anything about anything. They just said, we have a tape, it's a kirtan, it's one of our senior men, one of the acharyas leading a kirtan. This much information, they said, Singh, we wanted you to examine the quality of this sound and just give us your humble opinion. So he agreed, so they set a little tape recorder. I'm sorry if I'm boring anybody if you've already heard this, but they set a little tape recorder and they put a little set of those small earphones that just kind of go in there. So they got them all set up in his ear and they had it all set to, like, you know, a place where the kirtan was really going. And they hit the play button. It was set at a nice volume. They hit the play button and he just went and knocked the went like this and threw the headset off his thing. He listened to it for about, I don't know, 1 or 2 seconds, 3 seconds at the most. And he went like this and threw the headset off, and then he went, cleared his ears, and then he told him, it is Maya's kingdom, Maya's sound. And that was the discrimination that then led to so many other things after that point. And they could understand. And then, oh, it came out in history. Not only was that Maya, that was LSD's Maya that was stimulating those kirtans. That came out later. That person had become so degraded, he was taking LSD and then sitting down in front of all the devotees and chanting and becoming the big shot. And then he became a small shot. But the ordinary devotees couldn't distinguish. It sounded good, looked good, you know. He had tilak on, you know. He had a sikha. Guess he's a devotee. He's in ecstasy. Why not? He's been chanting for 20 years or something like this. No proper discrimination. Everything based on the externals. So there's a saying, it takes one to know one. There are some guidelines that we can follow who is a bona fide devotee. So many things, certainly devotional dress, tilak, neck beads, some of the externals are part of it. But if that's the only part of it, then what would you have thought if you walked into Prabhupada's pharmacy in 1926? And this little man standing there with a short cropped hair and a nice little mustache, and when the bell rang when you walked in, he would have said in Hindi, Bentie, Abkese, and you would have thought, man, Vaishnava's got a mustache. You would have just said, oh, I'll take the bottle of aspirin, and you would have left. Or what would you get there? Some chundas or something.
Liniment.
Some, you take some day's pain liniment and leave. Who could recognize? Who can recognize? Who can recognize a Vaishnava? Once there was this man, it was just somebody, and he came to the West, and the devotee said, Prabhupada, there's one guru who's come from India, he's got long hair and a beard, he's opening some mission, is he bona fide? This is in the early days. The Prabhupada said, I can't tell how bona fide he is by how long his hair is. Long or short, what does he say? What does he say? And that's where it begins, usually. But even then, some people master what to say. The sadhus, they've mastered what to say. You have to be a very, very close listener to understand the defect. The Nithaigur Radhe Shambhavas, they chant minimum 64 rounds a day. They do kirtan. They've been doing kirtan for 50 years, 24 hours a day, at the Samadhi of Raghunathas Goswami. It was 25 years. They've been doing it 25 years ago, so it's safe to say 50 years. 24 hours a day, nonstop for 50 years. And every bubba there chanting 64 rounds a day. Great cook circumambulating Govardhan. Sometimes they circumambulate Govardhan Hill before they even eat. Or something like this. How do you know how bona fide they are? You got to be a very keen listener and know what you're listening for. So in some cases, then you find out very subtleties that Nityananda Prabhu, he is in Madhurya Bhav. He is actually Radha Bhav. He is actually Radharani. They consider Nityananda Prabhu to be Radharani. As we consider the position of Gadadhar Pandit to be Radha Bhav, they consider it as Nityananda Prabhu. So, if you know the ontology of the Siddhanta, you know what is what, then you'll understand. But based on regular principles, very, very strict. No fooling around. Strict chanting. Strict sadhana. While we're still socking the pillow, those guys have already finished 30 rounds. But they are sadhus. Sadhu means they are materialists. A brand, a type of materialist. They are rejected and they have no entrance into the spiritual world. They remain in this material plane of consciousness. So how to know, you see? How to know? To save yourself is very easy now. Well, Guru Maharaj said, if you follow Guru Maharaj, then you just go, well, Guru Maharaj said, we don't read that book. So we don't read that book. Why does Guru Maharaj say, don't read that book? Don't read this book. Don't do that. So, you will have a chance to learn the right thing from the right people first. Later, you may look at so many books, and when knowing the real thing, the right thing, then you'll know, this is not the real one. This may be very fanciful. This may be very colorful. This may be very sweet. This might even be full of nectar, Prabhu. But you know, this is not the one. There's nobody in this room, probably except for myself, and maybe a couple of Vishnuvars and sannyasis, who can read the book called Advaita Prakash. Is it called Advaita Prakash? Which is for sale in ISKCON bookstores all over the world, and know the defect of this book. Because you're not that well read or studied, and we haven't discussed it. We read it and go, oh, this is nectar. This is pure nectar about Advaita Acharya. And it is.
But laced in that nectar is a particular poison, and it's meant just for you, the Gaudiyas, the followers of Gaur Nitai. The book is written by the followers of so-called followers of Advaitacharya. And there are a few things which they hold a contention with the Gaudiyas about, and in this book is where they set the stage to defeat you and your religious point of view about Mahaprabhu. This is where they defeat you and your whole parampara. And they have written this book just to make it so tasty for the Gaudiyas. It's just filled with the kind of nectar, Prabhu, that Gaudiyas love. And that's the bait. How do you catch a fish? You just put one of them big old slimy worms on a hook, dangle it out there, and the fish just, he's seen that hook 100 times, but look at that worm, whomp, and he comes and eats it. So they, what, nectar Prabhu? Real Krishna consciousness might not be so much nectar. It will be sacrifice. A lot of sacrifice. Not always nectar. A good hard day's work in Krishna's garden hurts. Your muscles ache. You get sunburned. Your back aches. That's not exactly nectar. But actually it is. It's another type of nectar. This sacrifice, this pain for Krishna, will produce the highest nectar in time when it is ripened. You finally get to retire. Somebody else does the hoeing. After you've blown your back out. So what is nectar? Better don't go for the nectar. Devotees used to have wild ways of dancing. Conservative in our kirtans. Of course, if we jump, we'd hit the ceiling. So it's understandable. But we're, mostly so conservative until several years ago, Vishnu Maharaj took the cap off of it in Govindaji Gardens and just got the boys over there, turned them into wild men in kirtans. And we've documented that in film also. But people would look at us and go, what's wrong with these people? They got broken legs? I mean, what's wrong with them? You got to be running up and down the temple room, spinning around, picking somebody up and passing them around in the air. You got to just get in there and pull your earrings out and just like let it rip, And that's ecstatic, Prabhu. It was an ecstatic kirtan. Bash the guy next to you with the kartal, stomp on a few. Get right in there and knock elbows, men and women too, Kirtan for the holy name. They call that ecstatic. So we're just a bunch of old futsies up here in Vermont, a bunch of woodchucks. So this has been going on a long time. So once seeing the fashion of that time, which was a little different than now, but it was still quite a fashionable kirtan. Srila Prabhupada said, tell them dance like I taught them in 1965. We used to call that the Prabhupada two-step. There's only two steps in the step. One to the left, one to the right. One to the left, one to the right. One to the left, one to the right. Put your hands up if you like, or clap your hands. That was called the Prabhupada step. He said, please tell them chant like I taught them. So this big announcement came down in Mayapur one morning when there were maybe 700 devotees in the temple room. Right after Arti, this announcement came. So that was the standard for the rest of the festival. When devotees went back to their stations around the world, in New Vrindavan, things just weren't as fired up as they used to be with these kind of old fogey-style kirtans. So the leading devotee there at that time, Kirtanananda, he wrote letters to the Prabhupada. He said, since we changed the style of kirtan, the kirtans just aren't ecstatic as they were before. Prabhupada wrote back and said, never mind ecstatic. Because he could understand that ecstasy, and he wrote about it one place, is just youthful bile secretion. It was written in Chaitanya Charitamrita. That ecstatic is just bile secretion. Actually, he didn't blame it on the youth, but compared to him, we were all youth. No, he said, there's this bile secretion. Hormones firing. real ecstasy of the holy name is another thing, and it's far superior. You may be frozen like stone. One ecstasy commands you to dance, laugh, cry, sing. Another one makes you frozen like stone. You see? But we never see that. Only the ecstatic is jumping like wild people. You see? We never see anybody mortified like stone, frozen in time. You see?